Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a great privilege to have with us a man who has been a friend for many years, has gone on to great things, both in the United States Treasury Department under President H.W. Bush, among other things, serving as a Deputy Assistant Secretary for Treasury, and also as the Executive Secretary to the President's Economic Policy Council. But that was all in a previous life. He went on to be a very successful banker in his native state of Arkansas, and now represents the people of the 2nd District of Arkansas in the United States House of Representatives, where he serves on its Financial Services Committee. He is Representative French Hill. Congressman, it's very good to have you back. Thank you very much for taking some time.
And Frank, it's always good to be with my great old friend of long standing. So glad to be with you this day.
We're old comrades in arms in the service of Senator John Tower, and it's very, very nice to have you back and doing so well in so many important capacities. Let me ask you, Congressman, about specifically a piece that you wrote about 2 months ago now, I guess, in Newsmax. You led it off with one of my all-time favorite lines from President Ronald Reagan. Would you just remind us of that line and how it bears on our time?
Well, we're always just a few seconds away, you know, from protecting liberty in every generation. And Reagan called that to mind in his famous talk. I used it as a way to remind people that we are in a global war on terrorism, and we have to have a strategy to win. And it can't be the fits and starts and poor structure that we've had in the last 7.5 years, where President Obama doesn't even recognize that we are at war and has done everything in his power to disengage, frankly, which has made the thing really a horrendous burden when you look at the rise of ISIS under his watch.
And one of the points that you make in this, which I guess you'd expect from a guy who has spent as much time as you have in the financial sector and in using instruments of finance, is that we're not bringing the full weight of American power to bear, among other things, through sort of economic warfare measures against the Islamic State and others, the state sponsors, for that matter, of this global jihad. Would you talk a little bit about how we could be doing better about that, Congressman Hill?
Well, we've had a year now of extensive hearings and, for some of the members, extensive consultation abroad on our terrorism task force as a part of the Financial Service Committee, which the whole focus has been in looking at terror finance. And it's something that has been severely overlooked. Let me give you a couple of examples. Really, until San Bernardino in Paris last winter, the rules of engagement in this Obama administration really didn't include financial targets. And I think the one your listeners know most about is the fact that we've allowed commerce between Raqqa, Syria, and Mosul, Iraq, ever since the Islamic State swept out of Syria into northern Iraq. We've allowed commerce to just go unchecked there. And video that you can find on the internet of oil trucks transiting that highway. Well, that is a financial target. Anything that is producing revenue for the Islamic State, the sale of antiquities, the sale of human trafficking victims, the extortion of people in northern Iraq and their alleged caliphate territory, the robbing of banks and the converting of oil to gold, which is then smuggled, or the sale of oil over the border into Turkey. All these things are sources of terror finance. And what we have argued consistently is they need to be military targets. And I circle back now to my comment about San Bernardino and Paris. Post San Bernardino and Paris, suddenly we're bombing these trucks. They no longer present an environmental risk, as the Obama administration used in the term, or that they might have civilian collateral damage. I mean, that's the nature of war, sadly. Of course, we want to minimize it. But the way to get to defeat this enemy, one way is to cut off its funding. And that is a major issue, and we need to make sure that we have financial targets also as military targets.
You know, one of the things that I really appreciated about that Newsmax column, Congressman French Hill, was your recognition that this still is a global conflict, and really, at least implicitly, that the Islamic State is just one manifestation of it. Another nation, which, as you know very well, you've been very sharply critical of some of the recent developments with respect to, is Iran, of course. That country is also engaged in a considerable degree of terrorism financing, as well as just terrorism, period. We've enabled it considerably with this $150 billion or so windfall. What are your current thoughts about that, and what should the United States be doing to try to curb those financial flows to terrorists as well?
Yeah, good question. And a lot of people are writing and talking about that this is the one-year anniversary of the agreement between the parties with Iran. But for me, Frank, June was the anniversary from June 2009 of Barack Obama and this administration turning their back on the people in Tehran and in Iran in their Green Revolution. It's a much sadder anniversary than just the one-year anniversary. We are enabling terrorism because the largest financial source of terror money for Hezbollah and Hamas, the Shia militias in Iraq, of course, are the Iranians. Their Quds Force operation is active in Latin America. It's active throughout Africa and in illicit finance. And by freeing up their money, they create that problem. So we are complicit by releasing their funds. And I think what one step we've done is, number one, we've got to maintain surveillance of any illegal terror finance activity they do. We still have the right to put on additional sanctions and block their efforts. Number two, just in June, the State Department released its annual country reports on terrorism. And again, Iran ranks at the top. So Mr. Royce, who chairs our Foreign Affairs Committee in the House, passed a bill called H.R. 4992, I think, U.S. Financial System Protection Act, which blocks Iran's ability to get access to the U.S. dollar.
And I was going to ask you about that. I trust you consider that to be a very important impediment.
Very, very important bill. We got some bipartisan support. The Treasury Department, my old department in government, argues, well, look, we already know they're a primary money laundering concern, and we deny them access to the dollar. That's true. And that's the Obama administration's defense. But the problem is they have a tendency, as you know, to go off script and do whatever they want to be complicit with some of the worst actors in the world. And so I thought, and I commend Chairman Royce for leading this effort. So that bill passed the House, and Senators Rubio and Kirk have a similar bill in the Senate. So that's something else that we should be
Let's hope they can get it out of the Senate and onto the president's desk and that he'll approve it. Let me ask you quickly before we let you go, Congressman French Hill. Of course, we've had a considerable fandango in Philadelphia the past couple of days. Hillary Clinton's record was put forward in a number of different speeches, including her own last night. I'd ask you quickly for a reaction.
Well, it was a shocking litany of progressive wish list that it was really a Bernie Sanders acceptance speech. I hope independents and center-right people across our country, and of course Republicans, recognize this for what it is, which is a Trojan horse. I don't want to see how Bill Clinton can applaud, since he gave the great State of the Union remarks one time, the era of big government is over. Well, not on the other side of the bedroom, apparently, because the era of big government has not even gotten a good start. I don't believe she's the right person to lead us vis-a-vis national security, homeland security, or the future of our domestic economy.
Well, I personally very strongly agree with that, and I think what you're hearing is going to be more of the record exposed in the course of this program and of a great many others that will be coming forward in, between now and the election. I hope you'll be on ours again in the near future. Congressman French Hill, thank you very much for your service on the Financial Services Committee and in the House of Representatives and on behalf of the people of the 2nd District of Arkansas, as well as all of the rest of us. Keep it up, sir. Come back to us again very soon. Ken Timmerman joins us next. We'll talk about deception, the YouTube, and Hillary.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say Ken Timmerman, one of the finest investigative reporters of our time, is joining us to talk, among other things, about his brand new book, very, very timely and very, very important contribution to our understanding of the nature of the Hillary Clinton record and perhaps what might be expected of her should she become our next commander-in-chief. The book is entitled Deception, The Making of the YouTube Video Hillary and Obama Blamed for Benghazi. Ken Timmerman, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me back on, Frank.
Well, so the YouTube in question, of course, involved Benghazi. Talk, if you would, a bit about who said what about that video and why it was a deception.
Well, what I found out as I was tracking how the video went viral was that the first U.S. journalistic reports pointing to it actually found a video that had been viewed by 405 people. So this was a video that was causing riots all across the Middle East, that it provoked the Benghazi attacks, 405 views. Simply wasn't true. We now know from the Benghazi Select Committee, Frank, that Hillary spent 2 hours in a meeting with White House political hacks, slow-rolling military reinforcements to Libya, ultimately none actually left. And 5 of their 10 action items involved this YouTube video. In other words, the deception, the cover-up of what was actually happening in Benghazi. So Hillary, in response to that 3 a.m. phone call, her response is cover-up, deny, distract, and lie.
Deflect is another word that you might throw into that mix, Ken Timmerman, and it certainly seems apt in all of those adjectives describing what she was up to in the midst of this crisis, one substantially of her own making, having denied requests in the past for improved security for the personnel in Benghazi. Our guest is Kenneth Timmerman. In addition to this new book, Deception, The Making of the YouTube Video, Hillary and Obama Blamed for Benghazi, he is also the author of Dark Forces, The Truth About What Happened in Benghazi. Ken, this episode, this pattern, really, of lies in the immediate aftermath of the attack in Benghazi and on a continuing basis thereafter, was really part of a larger policy failure on the part of the Obama administration. Would you talk a little bit about that as well?
Well, it was. And first of all, strictly on Libya, the policy failure was refusing to take into account something like 600 requests for additional security. But that comes after the initial failure, which was essentially switching our alliances from being pro-Israel, pro-moderate Arab regime, the Egypts of this world, even Gaddafi, who had been an ally, and Obama throwing in our lot, Hillary throwing in our lot with the Muslim Brotherhood. So they topple pro-American government in Egypt, in Libya, and help the Muslim Brotherhood and their jihadi brothers come into power. And that's really what has caused what we now see in the Middle East. The Middle East today is in flames, and it's in flames because of the policies of Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Now, you can argue that they were also involved to some extent in overthrowing the government of Tunisia, but they also were very actively involved. Indeed, Ken Timmerman, your reporting indicates this was a principal function, I believe, of the American outposts in Benghazi, namely helping to overthrow the government of Syria as well, which is a continuing and festering sore, of course.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that they did not want the public to understand. That's why they crafted the deception of the YouTube video. It was, look at my right hand. That's the video. Keep watching my right hand, Frank. Don't look over here at my left hand where I'm sending weapons to jihadi terrorists in Benghazi for groups in Syria and beyond.
Including members of Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Including, absolutely, including members of Al-Qaeda and including surface-to-air missiles that have shown up all over the world and that took down a U.S. helicopter in Afghanistan.
The kind of record and of judgment and policy conduct that I think you didn't hear much out of the Democrats in their convention, but should be very carefully examined in the course of the upcoming election. Hey, Ken, let me switch gears if I could. We have recently been treated to, at long last, at least a redacted version of what turned out to be 29 pages, not 28, of information a congressional committee pulled together shortly after 9/11 concerning that attack. It involved a considerable degree of information that had not yet been made public about the Saudis and what part they played in that attack. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it did, and it showed that there were individuals who were believed to be undercover Saudi intelligence officers who were in direct contact with many of the 9/11 hijackers, who helped them, who provided financial assistance to them, who found housing for them, and introduced them into the network of people in the United States who could cover for them and help them to go to ground. The 29 pages in their conclusion, Frank, if I read it correctly, they could not 100% confirm that those individuals were Saudi intelligence officers. But they said, you know, we suspect to be Saudi intelligence officers. The Saudi government, of course, says no, they weren't, and they were not acting in any official capacity. And I'm sure that that is the line that they will continue to put out.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that really struck me about these 29 pages, Ken Timmerman, was the degree to which it was made clear that the United States counterintelligence entities were not tracking these Saudi operatives in the run-up to 9/11, evidently on the grounds that they were such good allies that that wasn't appropriate. That really struck me as bizarre. Let me ask you about one other piece of this, Ken. You were an expert witness in the lawsuit brought by some of the victims of 9/11 that led to a ruling by a federal judge involving another state sponsor of terrorism and its role in all of this. It turns out from the 29 pages that the Saudis were doing a lot with the Iranians. Talk about the role that Iran played in that attack and what we are to make of the fact that these two putative enemies, the Shiites and the Sunnis, nonetheless got together to kill Americans.
Well, and the Iranians continue to this day, Frank, to shelter senior al-Qaeda operatives in Iran and to provide assistance to them.
A couple of them were just sanctioned by the Treasury Department, as I recall.
Just a couple of days ago, you know, just a week ago. And so this is an ongoing pattern. I like to put it this way. People think that the Saudis and the Iranians, because they come from different sects of Islam, hate each other, can never work together. I put it this way. They'll eat each other up for breakfast, but when it comes to lunch, and eating up Americans or killing Jews, they get along just fine. So it really depends what the objective is. The Iranians helped the Al-Qaeda plot on 9/11 by providing them safe passage through Iran into Afghanistan in the months before the plot. Why was that important? Because they had to get their clean, freshly issued Saudi passports with U.S. visas. They had to keep them clean so they could come into the United States.
And evidently the Saudis were complicit in doing that.
Well, they issued them the new passports. And you could say the State Department was complicit because they issued them visas. But they had to get in and out of Afghanistan without any passport stamps. And the Iranians did that. The Iranians knew exactly what they were doing.
I'm afraid we are out of time, as usually the case, well before we've exhausted the things there are to talk with you about. I hope you'll let us come back, ask you to come back again soon to visit further about all of these things. In the meantime, again, congratulations on Deception, the making of the YouTube video Hillary and Obama blamed for Benghazi. Keep up the good work, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Garry Kasparov. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The prognosis for Europe just got a lot worse. A year ago, German Chancellor Angela Merkel opened her country's doors and effectively those of the European Union to limitless immigration. A human tsunami from the Middle East, North Africa, and other Muslim nations ensued. The results have been disastrous for Merkel's nation and for Western civilization. Well over 1 million mostly Muslim migrants have wound up in Germany alone. Few seem disposed to assimilate, and a growing number appear to be Islamic supremacists bent on jihadist conquest or are in the process of adopting their ideology Sharia and that stated goal. Unbelievably, in the wake of 4 murderous Islamist attacks in Germany, Chancellor Merkel has just doubled down. She reaffirmed her open border policy, inviting a further Islamist invasion and possibly setting the stage for Europe's next conflagration. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I could not be more pleased to say, joined by an old friend and one of the men I admire most in the world, in fact, Garry Kasparov, the longtime world chess champion and, as important, really, one of the great leaders for freedom in his native Russia, Soviet Union in the past, but worldwide, really, an exemplar of the kind of courage and clarity of vision that is so desperately needed these days. I am privileged to say he's been one of our keepers of the flame at the Center for Security Policy and a great inspiration for many years. His most recent book could hardly be more topical. Winter is Coming. Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped. Garry Kasparov, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you.
Thanks for inviting me again, Frank.
Let me ask you, the focus of your book, of course, is Vladimir Putin. Briefly, how would you characterize Putin's game at the moment?
Putin has a very simple game. He must stay in power at any cost. And since he ran out of enemies in Russia, he needs to beef up his propaganda by creating enemies elsewhere. And his aggression against the Republic of Georgia and lately against Ukraine, his permanent threats to the former Soviet republics in the Baltic area, his clandestine games in Europe when he's trying to undermine established European institutions like European Union and NATO, demonstrates that he needs chaos. He needs to create uncertainty because that's the only climate where he can thrive. And right now he looks at America as the biggest prize he can covet because having Donald Trump as a Republican nominee offers him a unique opportunity to aim at the United States institutions, political and military institutions, that have secured global peace for decades.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that game, and we're talking about it in kind of the chess sense of the word, vis-a-vis the American political election at the moment. The White House and the Democratic National Convention were roiled, of course, by the revelations of some of the emails of the Democratic National Committee right in the midst of the convention. Is there any doubt in your mind, Garry Kasparov, that Vladimir Putin was behind both the hacking into the DNC servers and to the release of those compromising documents at that particular moment in time?
The only shocking news for me in the whole story is that many Americans are being shocked by the fact that Putin could be involved in hacking and releasing these emails. And I'm afraid that hacking is not the worst thing Putin can do. Let's not forget, in year 2000, his election was marked by apartment bombings, and Putin has a dire record of spilling blood of his own citizens to secure his staying power. So I think it's vital that the current administration, no matter how weak and pathetic Obama's policy, global policy, was over the last years, must be very vigilant to make sure that American elections will not have the same dark influence of Putin and his partisans.
So a man capable of that is certainly capable of very direct intervention and cynical manipulation in our own government circles and country at a highly politicized moment. What is your sense of his attitude towards these two candidates? Hillary Clinton, of course, and Bill Clinton benefited substantially, it appears, from the Clinton Foundation's dealings with Putin's cronies, at least, in connection with a uranium deal. He's also obviously got something of a, well, they call it a bromance, I guess, going now with Trump. What are we to make of these relationships?
Look, I can hardly make comments about Democratic nominee because my criticism of Hillary and Bill Clinton and, of course, Obama administration is well documented. The problem is that Donald Trump and his statements and his future plans, they are making Hillary Clinton looking like John Dark. Because while we know the Hillary's flaws, but at least Kremlin has to work hard to get her emails. The problem with Trump that he has already suggested that his policy toward Russia would change dramatically from the sort of current. Even those sanctions today, they are, in my view, they're quite mild, and Obama's response to Putin's aggression and his intervention in and meddling in European and Middle Eastern affairs, the response was very weak. But Trump now wants to build new, strong, friendly relations with a Russian dictator, and I wouldn't say that it's just a sarcastic comment or a moody statement, because unlike with many other issues where Trump flip-flops regularly, with Russia he's quite consistent, and he keeps demonstrating his affinity to dictators like Putin or Erdogan and the authoritarian rules. He is even challenging indirectly the First Amendment, talking about, you know, new libel laws, and of course this is ideal candidate for Putin. I would say that if Republicans had anybody else, probably Putin would look more friendly to Democrats and to Hillary Clinton. But in the current climate, I think Trump is his strong favorite.
Garry Kasparov, let me ask you, again, coming to this topic, not only as a grandmaster of chess, but also as the author of Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped. Is there any question in your mind that the natural response, not only of Vladimir Putin, but also of other enemies of freedom, to the kinds of signals that are being sent here by Donald Trump to some extent, and, well, for that matter, by the Democrats in their way as well. Weakness or conciliation or even submission is going to embolden these enemies of freedom, far from stopping.
Look, it's not about the future. It's not hypothetical. We saw the outcome of Obama's failed policy for almost 8 years. Obama's policy of retreat failed, and as you could see, emboldened enemies of the free world, creating vacuum, whether it's in Eastern Europe or in the Middle East or in any other sensitive parts of the globe, doesn't mean that the place stays vacant. This vacuum is always being filled by the thugs and dictators, as we could see in Syria, Iraq, Ukraine, and elsewhere, where Putin grabbed every opportunity, and Putin and his partisans and other enemies of the free world, they grabbed every opportunity presented by Obama's covered this policy.
And that's, I guess, the crux of this point. We've got to stop these enemies of freedom. This is an existential threat, as we talked about earlier in the program with Congressman French Hill, our generation's existential threat to freedom. Garry Kasparov, in the course of your time, both as the world chess champion and as one of your country's most prominent dissidents, you have really helped us understand what's at stake in this struggle for freedom. It is an incredibly important theme of this important new book, Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped. Thank you for coming aboard to talk a little bit with us about those stakes and help us think through the importance of getting this right in an election that may be of extraordinary significance, not just for America, of course, but for the free world. Come back to us again soon, my friend, if you would. In the meantime, stay well and keep up your good work.
I hope, Frank, that, you know, at one point we can discuss sort of positive vision of the future and not to be squeezed to look for the lesser evil.
Amen. Elon Berman joins us next. We'll continue our conversation about Russia, Turkey, and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Elon Berman joins us from the American Foreign Policy Council, where he serves as a vice president. He is a prolific contributor to national security debates on a whole host of topics, notably through his column at Forbes.com. Also, his myriad books, the most recent of one of which is Iran's Deadly Ambitions. We hope to talk to him about that. But before we do, I wanted to pick up with you, Elon. First of all, let me say welcome. Glad to have you back, as always.
Oh, thank you.
But I did want to pick up on a conversation that I just had with Garry Kasparov about the state of Russian and Putin's ambitions as they relate to, among other things, the neighborhood, of course, and our internal domestic political scene. What are your thoughts on what Putin is up to in those regards?
Putin is nothing if not an opportunist, and the view from the Kremlin, I think, is overwhelmingly favorable, just abroad in general, but in particular in places like the Middle East, where the United States, under President Obama, hasn't marshaled anything resembling a coherent strategy. And, you know, there's an old Russian adage that says that, you know, a sacred space shall not remain empty. And, you know, I think that's something that the Russian government takes very much to heart. And as they look abroad, they're seeing a tremendous amount of empty space in the Middle East, also, frankly, in Europe, and even in the territory where NATO is ramping up its operations. I think the Russians see a great amount of potential opportunities to expand their influence and sort of recapture the vision of themselves as a great power.
Gary was commenting on the prospect that Vladimir Putin is seeing a potential partner in some of this vacuum filling in Donald Trump, and that that may be contributing to his willingness to intervene rather directly in our election this year, notably through this business of releasing hacked emails to coincide with the Democratic National Convention. How do you see all of that, Ilan Berman?
No, I think Gary's right, and I think the trend line is very troubling insofar as the apparent affinity of Mr. Trump for Vladimir Putin and his sort of his familiarity and also his willingness to apparent willingness to negotiate with the Russians, I think creates a very jittery Europe as a whole, and in particular a very jittery Eastern Europe, where more and more countries that are on Russia's periphery are beginning to envision the possibility of a future where the Russians feel like they have a freer hand to push against the sort of their borders, push against their sovereignty, infringe on their sovereignty, and do so not just with America doing very little, as we have now, but with America's acquiescence, which is something we might have in the future.
Were you surprised, Ilan Berman, at the comment that Newt Gingrich made about 2 weeks ago, I guess now, with respect to Estonia being a suburb of St. Petersburg, the implication seemingly being that even a guy who's I consider to be very serious about national security issues in the United States is sort of taking the, well, shall we say, laissez-faire view of what Putin may have in terms of his designs on the Baltic states.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was less surprised, say, than the Estonians, because it's frankly news to them. But I think what you highlight is exactly right. You know, there is this trend line among some in the national security community to have a more hands-off approach to what Russia claims, justly or unjustly, what Russia claims as its geopolitical sphere of influence. And, you know, for if history as a whole, but recent history in particular, as any judge, the Russians will see this as an emboldening move, a move that will create greater, not less, Russian attempts to revise the post-Cold War settlement, the sort of the post-World War II settlement in Europe. Just simply put, Russia, if it senses that the U.S. isn't going to push back as forcefully on its aggression as it did before, is likely to be more aggressive, not less.
Let me turn to another of your very many areas of expertise, Ilan Berman. We had the spectacle today, or recently at least, of Angela Merkel. She has, of course, been negotiating a lot with the Turks of late concerning these refugee, so-called refugee migrant flows into Germany and other parts of the European Union. Turkey has had its own problems, of course, a coup most recently, and now purges. What are we to make, Ilan Berman, of what's happening with the Turks and what their travails may translate into still further problems for the European continent, specifically with respect to the rising tide of jihad there?
Turkey, it's unquestionable that Turkey is undergoing a political upheaval that's really seismic. And I think everybody understands that the botched coup that was attempted on July 14th and the aftermath, the purge that Turkish President Erdogan has launched since then, has reshuffled the deck in a pretty profound way in terms of Turkish domestic politics. You have, you know, over 60,000 people whose loyalties are suspect from every walk of life, either getting detained or fired from their jobs. You have, you know, like thousands of institutions from schools to universities to newspapers getting shut down. This is a pretty significant overhaul of Turkish society in a distinctly authoritarian direction. But it also has, I think, long-term strategic implications. It's not just that we're losing Turkey as a nascent democracy. It's that the coup has given the Erdogan government, which has historically been hostile to the Turkish military, which is the custodians of the idea of separation of mosque and state, the custodians of the secular legacy of Ataturk. The AKP, the current government ruling party, because of the coup, now has the opportunity and the initiative and the incentive to really eviscerate the military in a lasting fashion. And that has all sorts of implications for Turkey's participation in NATO, Turkey's willingness and ability to burden share with the Atlantic Alliance. And I think this is something that we're going to see play out over the next couple of years. But already the European planners are, very correctly worrying tremendously about a Turkey that is nominally, at least on paper, part of Europe, but ideologically, institutionally, is more and more Islamist and more Middle Eastern. And what does that actually mean?
Let me ask you about that other bit, though, Ilhan Berman. The Turks have, under Erdogan, greatly exacerbated the problems inside Europe at the moment. In Germany, I mean, Angela Merkel's comments come in the aftermath of no fewer than four jihadist attacks in about a week or so. What do you make of what's going on there? Your almanac of the jihad is really an incredibly important tool, but it's on the rise for sure. Are we looking at the possibility, in your judgment, of civil war in Europe, as some are saying?
Well, I think we're certainly heading in something that looks troublingly similar to that circumstance, and Turkey is, I think, a very big part of this. Turkey is very candidly the weak link in the European security paradigm. Right? Europe is suffering from these migration waves, and waves plural, because we're not just talking about refugees from Syria. We're also talking about opportunist refugees from North Africa who are seeking employment and sort of all this stuff. But the dynamic that they've created, this social friction and the uptick in radical Islamist activity within Europe is very real. And Turkey is the weak link, among other things, because Turkey has served up until now as a conduit for foreign fighters from Europe to join the Islamic State and vice versa. And as a result, as Turkey undergoes this political transformation, as Turkey becomes increasingly unreliable for Europe, and as tensions rise with NATO, Turkey's role as the weak link in that alliance, I think, comes more and more into question, and the likelihood of a rupture with Europe becomes greater than ever before.
We have to leave it at that for the moment, Ilhan Berman, but there's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll let us do it again soon. Thank you very much, as always, for the great work you do at the American Foreign Policy Council and Forbes. And next up, we'll talk with Mauricio Clavier-Caron about Cuba and Venezuela. And you, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Mauricio Clavier-Caron is in the house, I'm happy to say, a man who has been working tirelessly and for many years on behalf of freedom in a very important part of the world to Americans, namely Cuba, from whence he hails. He has been a leader of the Cuban democratic movement in this country, notably as the executive director of the Cuban Democracy Public Advocacy, also from his vantage point as a host of From Washington Al Mundo on Sirius XM's Christina Radio Network. He has also been blogging tirelessly at Capitol Hill Cubans, where you can find his very important contributions to the public policy debate about what we're doing with this so-called normalization of relations with Cuba. Mauricio Clavier-Caron, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm delighted to have you.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure as always.
You got my attention the other day with a posting about how Obama's policies have actually expanded the power and actually the control of the Cuban military in Cuba and perhaps beyond. Give us a sense of how that's happened.
Yeah. Well, look, 99% of Obama's policy towards Cuba has been all spin. And then, of course, the media kind of feeds off it. And then it's the cars and the tourism and then the trip. But it's really a policy of distractions. 99% spin, distractions from the reality. And one of the most important issues and one of the biggest untold stories of this new policy, the biggest, not change per se, because it was always going in that direction, but the biggest consequence of the policy is the complete control of the Cuban military over the Cuban economy. The entire purpose, supposedly, you know, there was well-intentioned supporters of Obama's policy that said, hey, this was going to help empower the Cuban people. It was going to help them create a space of economic freedom that then it would translate into political freedom, which I that's a philosophical argument I disagree with. But okay, at least it's a well-intentioned argument, etc. But the exact opposite is happening. Even that small space for what they used to be called the self-employment sector has been decreasing. They're under constant threats by the regime because now the most lucrative sectors, anything that touches upon an American traveler, an American business enterprise, or things of the sort, is being absolutely controlled and captured by the Cuban military. There's been a lot of military dictators in the Western Hemisphere, particularly in the 20th century. But the one thing that makes Cuba different is that the Cuban military also controls the economy. It used to be almost 80% of the Cuban economy. Unfortunately, that number is getting bigger now. And some of the few entities that used to be outside the space of the conglomerates, the commercial conglomerates of the Cuban military, there's a couple of hotel companies in the old Havana, in the tourist sector, in the port of Havana, where now cruise ships come. Those even used to be, they were still under the regime, but under the Ministry of Tourism, under some civilians' control, quote-unquote, etc. Now, they've just been outright taken over by the conglomerates of the Cuban military and the Ministry of the Revolutionary Armed Forces. That's a very concerning trend.
Mauricio, let me ask you about one other aspect of this misbegotten venture of the United States in normalization relations with Cuba, namely the effect of essentially taking over from Venezuela the job of propping up the regime economically. We now see pretty clearly why Castro's regime was so interested in hooking up with Obama. But have we in fact now begun supplanting its one-time patron that is now in bankruptcy itself?
Unfortunately, but that goes to another greater point. Some people might say, well, okay, so the Cuban military is getting richer. What's the point? We might have short-term memories, but you don't really need to have that much of a short-term memory because Venezuela is case in point of why the Cuban military is so dangerous. The second greatest untold story, I guess, or part of this in this trend of the 21st century, frankly, as a scholar Moises Naim has said before, has been the takeover by Cuba's essentially bankrupt military regime over the most resource-rich nation in the Western Hemisphere, be it Venezuela. So if you think that by now empowering the Cuban military even greater is going to help somehow or cause some good, look at Venezuela. That is right there a direct product of the intervention, of the subversion of democracy by the Cuban military regime. By the way, and I'd also mention something that's very different from, for example, Iran, Russia, and other geopolitical foes that we have. Cuba is one of the few countries, is one of the foes that we have that there are still senior Cuban military officials indicted by U.S. federal courts for the murder of Americans. That's important. You know, these are not good players. This is a very concerning trend. Now, the fact that some people will say that the new spin now, as we're seeing with the Obama administration, is that, well, the fact of Venezuela's collapse is actually a good thing in that it's helping bring Cuba closer to the United States. That's a cute spin, but that's not reality. What it's helping do is the United States to bail out the Cuban regime, and the Cuban regime is going to use it and abuse it. And look, I'm all about U.S. business, and I think U.S. business is a great thing and it's a great force, but it's not a charity, and U.S. business are not NGOs. They're out to make a profit. And if they're going to make money from Castro, they're going to make money from Castro. They're going to take that money and they're going to run. They're not going to go out there and promote democracy and freedom in Cuba. And Castro knows that. So therefore, it's a very specific calculation to his benefit that he's making.
Well, in a way, worse. To the extent that the Cubans don't have any money to make those business ventures profitable or the tourist operations that might flow from them profitable, there will be American taxpayers who will be on the hook to try to make all this work. And that's another very dubious proposition. Let me ask you about one other thing, Mauricio. Obviously, you mentioned the very deleterious effect of Castro's involvement with Venezuela, but isn't it the case that even today there's a general by the name of Carlos Fernandez Gondan who is actually very directly involved in propping up the failed Maduro government in Venezuela? What's up with that?
Carlos Fernandez Gondan is currently the Minister of the Interior. He's a MINFAR, meaning a Cuban Defense Ministry General, who's now the Minister of the Interior in Cuba. But he was previously in charge of overseeing Cuban operations in Venezuela. Look, we know names and titles of those in Venezuela, of the Cuban military officials that are essentially running Venezuela's Ministry of Defense. The defense minister, who has now essentially been taking over the commercial operations of the Maduro regime and the political operations of the Maduro regime, was just in Cuba last year receiving orders from and if you see it on his Twitter feed, from his comandante, from his commander, in that case being Fidel Castro. This is a direct control. It's a direct proposition that's taking place there, which is very concerning. And it's also, you know, the question that I asked myself over and over again, not only the Obama administration, but even in Congress and even in amongst the media, why isn't Cuba being held responsible right before our eyes for one of the greatest cases of subversion of democracy? Look, we talk about, and now the Democrats have suddenly seen the light with Russia, and we talk about Russia and the Crimea and Russia and its aggressions in Europe, et cetera, right in our backyard. Cuba is responsible for the subversion of democracy in the most resource-rich nation in the Americas, and we're giving it a pass. Not only are we giving it a pass, we're rewarding it for it. That's just a horrible proposition.
It is. It's an abnegation of everything we stand for. It is a curse upon the Cuban people. It is ultimately, I'm afraid, actually a security problem for us as well. As you have pointed out and do with great regularity at Capitol Hill Cubans, Mauricio Claver Caron, Executive Director of Cuba Democracy Public Advocacy, thank you for your time today and for the important work you're doing on behalf of not just freedom in Cuba, but freedom here as well. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.